Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life. Additional support for The Pulse is provided by AstraZeneca and Independence Blue Cross.
Who cares? How many times do you say that in a day, or at least think it? Some new research on why we really, really shouldn't eat sugar. One more don't ever do this move in parenting. Donald Trump said another outrageous thing. Who cares? Now think about an issue that means a lot to you. Education, free speech, whatever it is, and say it differently. Change the inflection. Who cares? And why? Can you make people care? I'm Maiken Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
What's actually in my fridge right now? Do we have yogurt or not?
Therefore, there's a code to cover that scenario.
That's not it. That's not it at all.
This is working for me. I'm going to stick with it, baby.
Ooh. Oh, there you go.
So funny.
I am a machine.
Some people go too hard. They say, like, I'm not going to have any more sodas.
You know, you didn't have blood tests to determine whether to
interrupt this task that is probably really important.
When do I get to survive?
If you could survive,
when you truly, at the end of that, you feel alive.
On today's show, do we care more about winning the game or protecting young brains? Can we do both? Not talking football, by the way. Speaking of sports, what if we were as passionate about climate change as we are about our favorite teams? Bill Nye thinks that would change the world. But first up, sometimes a weird turn or tragic twist in our lives makes an issue visible to us. It was here all along, but we didn't see it or care about it. Physician Naveen Vij has kept a secret. Actually, his body has, hiding it from him since he was born. It's a secret that millions of other people in this country also carry, and many don't even know about it. Alana Gordon takes it from here.
So let's start at the beginning.
So I was delivered via C-section on June 22nd, 1983.
This story begins at Naveen Vij's birth. 27 weeks. Naveen was a micropreemie. He stayed in the intensive care unit for a couple months. He was eventually released and grew into a healthy kid. Throughout his childhood, his mom would repeat a phrase to him, one that really stuck.
But one of the things my mom used to say all the time is everything kind of happens for a reason, and the challenge in good and bad is to figure out why. Sometimes she'd say it in Hindi, but that's exactly how she would say it to me.
Okay, fast forward 26 years. It's 2009. Naveen's on track to become a doctor.
And during the first year, which is called intern year, I was doing a procedure at work.
A blood draw.
In the intensive care unit, and got needle stuck.
He accidentally got stuck by a needle. Health providers dread this because it can be serious. But Naveen didn't think much of it. Still, he stopped by employee health services and had his blood and the patient's blood checked.
And then kind of went back to my routine of residency.
A few days later, employee health services contacted him. It was a phone call that totally changed his life.
And they told me that I had hepatitis C. And I just remember my world stopping. I remember the air being sucked out of the room. I remember just standing in this hallway at work, sort of feeling dumbfounded, feeling like I was having a moment of deja vu that wouldn't ever go away.
What did you know about Hep C, or what were you thinking about?
I mean, I knew Hep C was one of the leading causes of liver disease in the world. I knew that it was the leading cause of liver transplant in the United States. More worrisome for me is I'd seen people in the intensive care unit who were dying from complications from hepatitis C, cirrhosis, and liver damage. And I put myself in that bed. It scared me.
The first call Naveen made was to his mom.
She said, "Don't worry. Whatever it is, we'll figure it out, and everything will be okay." And after getting off the phone with my mom, that phrase came back to me. Everything happens for a reason. The challenge in good and bad is to figure out why.
In his search for why, Naveen also set out on a mission to understand how he even got it. Hep C is spread through blood-to-blood contact, often through sharing needles. But it turns out that patient didn't have hepatitis C.
Jesus, right. So
Naveen pulls out an orange folder out of a drawer in his apartment. It contains medical records.
These were some of my records here.
He started searching deeper into his past.
And then this is my mom's discharge summary for when I was born in 1983. You know, it says this patient was born at Abbott Northwestern Hospital on the 22nd of June.
Naveen was reminded of going through treatments in the NICU as a preemie. And at that time, the nation's blood supply wasn't being screened for hepatitis C.
And I started thinking about that. Well, 1983, I was in the NICU, so that had to be it.
So you didn't just have hep C for a few years?
No. I had the realization very quickly that I had been probably living with it for about 26 years, which made it more scary.
Hepatitis C is sneaky. It's not like a cold where you immediately know it and get sniffles or a sore throat. It often remains silent for decades until it's already damaged the liver. An estimated 3 million people in the U.S. have it, and the number of associated deaths have surpassed that of HIV infections. But most people don't even know they have it. When Naveen first learned of his diagnosis, he actually wanted to keep quiet about it.
And did a lot of your medical colleagues know about this?
No. I didn't feel comfortable talking to a lot of people about it.
He told his girlfriend, now wife, Abby, who's a nurse. They were surprised how, even in their well-educated medical circle, there was misinformation and stigma.
I remember she came home one day and sort of talked about how she was taking care of a patient who had hepatitis C in the intensive care unit.
You know, I was in the patient's room and touched the bed rail, and one of my superiors at the time, like, chastised me for touching the rail without gloves on. And
sort of yelled at her, like, don't touch the bed rail. The patient has hepatitis C. She's like, what? What the hell are you talking about?
Thought at the time, I've been a lot closer to it than this.
She knew she couldn't get it through touching a bed rail. Hep C has no vaccine, and only a small portion of those infected naturally clear the virus. The main option has long been a drug combination that includes regular injections for 6 months. Naveen started treatment, but stayed in residency.
It was kind of tough at times.
Kind of?
Kind of tough.
He was dehydrated. He had chronic flu symptoms. He was depressed. And these treatments that were available at that time weren't even guaranteed to work. There was a 20 to 40% chance they wouldn't. But as Naveen was going through this, something else happened. His mom was getting pretty sick. She had developed head and neck cancer. A few months later, as Naveen was wrapping up his own treatments, she died. Right after that, Naveen found out that his own treatment had worked. He was cured of hepatitis C.
It was just a very bittersweet moment. If you open up to, like, most of these pictures of my mom, there's the same big smile. It's from my high school graduation. There she is with my brother.
Naveen flips through old photos of his mom, pointing out her big smile.
There's a picture of the whole family.
I asked him if he thought about how she would have reacted, what she would have said to him.
At that moment, I can imagine my mom doing a little dance, smiling, giving me a big hug, but really thinking about sort of how do you pay this forward. She'd be like, look, see, you got through this, but it's not the end of this. You know, this happened for a reason, and this has changed your life. But the point is not necessarily how it just changed your life. It's what are you going to do with it to help change the lives of other people? You know, I was lucky to get that needle stick. I was lucky to find out my diagnosis. I was lucky to have support to get through treatment, and I was lucky to be cured. And I think, you know, when I went back to medicine, when I thought about sort of patients I was taking care of, and when I thought about hepatitis C, I want other people to feel lucky.
Today, Naveen has been working through advocacy and research to amplify the voices of what's long been a silent disease. But he's troubled that as much as treatments have improved since he went through it 5 years ago, that won't mean anything if people aren't screened, if hepatitis C remains a secret even to those who have it. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
Hepatitis hepatitis C is serious. It can be deadly. And as we just heard, it's also really sneaky. Many people don't know for years and years that they have it. So why are we not testing more people for this illness? We wanted to find out more about that. So we called up NYU medical ethicist Art Kaplan, and I asked him what stands in the way.
It's a complex set of factors, but the major one, I would say, is it's a low-incidence disease, despite the fact that many, many Americans have it. It's only probably 2% of the overall population. The cost of general screening might be high relative to what you're going to detect. Focusing in on at-risk groups, I think, has been seen as a better strategy than general screening. And I think the other reason is, up until recently, the treatments we had were not that great. They didn't work that well. But now we've suddenly got a very effective non-side effects intervention that seems to really work. That makes people really pay attention to who's got the disease, who could we pick up and detect for it and get the medicine to them. So it's a little bit, to make an analogy that's strained, but it's somewhat similar. No one wanted to talk about impotence for a very long time in men. And then came the erectile dysfunction drugs, and now they talk about it every minute on sports events. So out of the closet it came when a treatment appeared.
But this very effective treatment is also very expensive. So how is that going to impact things?
It is clear that Medicaid programs in different states can't really afford the prices. The VA is exceedingly nervous about the impact of this new drug on its budget. There's only one answer to this. We're going to have to bargain down the price or guilt or shame down the price. The price must be driven down.
Does that happen? Has that happened in the past?
We have seen it happen. It happened with AIDS drugs. Initially, they were sky high. The patient community got in line with many of the payers and began to force the prices down. There is precedent.
But if I'm the drug developer and my company has worked long and hard to develop this drug, then I'm not going to be very keen on pushing the price down right away.
So I think it's fair to say that the drug company puts in the time, puts in the effort. They don't want to see the price come down. They know what it costs to do a liver transplant on somebody, which was a prior quote-unquote treatment. They know what it costs to use other drugs that weren't nearly as good and had bad side effects, so they're pricing that way. However, I think there's a special moral obligation that companies in this pharmaceutical sphere have to give more access. So if you drop the price down and you then start to open up new markets overseas at cheaper prices, I think they can still, roughly speaking, make close to or fairly close to the amount of money they were going to make just by selling it at the highest price to the richest countries. And let's face it, the drug costs here are way higher than they're going to be in Europe, for example. We always put up with that, and I think this may be the time with a disease that affects so many people that we're just not going to put up with it and start to say, if you're going to sell it for $50,000 in Britain or $60,000 in Germany, then that's what we're expecting to pay here.
There are some people who say, as a society, we don't care enough about hepatitis C, or maybe even the field of public health hasn't done enough to raise awareness, to get people screened. Is this disease harder to get people to care about, maybe because it lies hidden for so long in so many people?
I do think hepatitis C has been a silent epidemic, a silent plague for a very long time. It's been a problem for decades. And yet, despite all we know about HIV, which is kind of a similar disease, also a similar disease in terms of taking a while to develop effective treatments, hepatitis C gets very, very little attention. And I think I know why. It's because of the shame of how you get it. The primary way to contract hepatitis C is through needle exchange, exchanging drugs among drug abusers. People don't like to admit that they ever did that. Every person I ask, how did you get hepatitis C, will tell me they got it from a blood transfusion. I don't think we've had a case of hepatitis C through blood transfusion in 25 years. We screen that very effectively in the blood supply. It's shame, it's stigma that have kept this quiet for so long.
If we do more screenings, who should be screened if you focus on higher risk groups?
You're probably going to look at people who come into the emergency room who may have overdosed or that you know are in a drug treatment program. You might move in there and start to get screening done. You certainly might be able to do it by people who have donated blood and have turned up to be in a risk group. You want to make sure that connects, if you will, back to their physician. People who've received blood before 1992, if we have records on them, we might do an outreach or contact approach and see if those older recipients of blood could be found and need to be screened. It's not easy, but it could be done.
Art Kaplan heads the Division of Medical Ethics at New York University. This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. Riding a bike, especially in heavy city traffic, can feel a little bit like you're playing Frogger. Car doors open suddenly, other bicyclists fly by against traffic trying to beat red lights, trolley tracks trap your wheels, drivers are so busy texting they never see you coming. So it feels good to wear a helmet, right? A little bit of protection. It's not that easy. Try reading the science on bike helmets and you'll find conflict. Ask the experts and they don't agree. Tanya English checked into this issue, starting with a bike ride in Philadelphia.
Let's go.
Russell Medin from Bike Share Philadelphia came along to show me the way.
She shouldn't be on the right of a car that's turning right.
Oh, that's bad.
That's not real good.
Medin does not wear a helmet. He has his regular work clothes, slacks, a maroon tie, and a sports coat. No spandex or special gear.
If you're a NASCAR or a Formula One driver, yeah, you should be wearing a helmet. If you're a pro cycle racer, yeah, you should be wearing a helmet.
Helmets give the wrong message, Medin says. When you see someone in a helmet, automatically you think that what they're doing is dangerous. He believes the stats that say you're more likely to get hurt slipping in the bathtub or falling from a ladder. Still, I was a little intimidated by the city buses passing on our left.
Walking on the sidewalk is just as dangerous.
There's no buses on the sidewalk, Russell.
Generally.
Wear a helmet if you want. But Medin says mandatory helmet laws discourage biking. And when there are fewer cyclists on the road, those roads are less safe. He wants to get more people up on bikes and to design cities so it's more comfortable to ride.
I don't bike without a helmet. I don't think the roads are really designed for bikers still.
Sarah Weitz-Kotacek is a public radio host in Little Rock, Arkansas. She's a longtime city biker who says accidents happen. Hers happened in Philadelphia.
So I was biking up to the intersection there in the lane, the bike lane, and a guy just suddenly opened his door so quickly that I didn't have time to brake. The front of my bike slammed into the door.
Weitz-Kotacek and her bike went up and over the door.
I texted my boss. I said, I've been in an accident. I'm going to be a few minutes late.
She arrived at her morning meeting with a little blood on her face, a strained jaw, and years later, she still has a small scar on her chin. Randy Swart from the nonprofit Bicycle Helmet Safety Institute says what we know for sure is that helmets help in the crashes that are very common among cyclists.
If you're wearing a helmet and you crash with no car involved, you're very unlikely to die. If you get hit by a car, all bets are off. You're flying through the air at who knows what speed, and after that, things are bad.
He encourages riders to wear a helmet, but says he gets the sense that many millennials were overprotected as kids, and now as adults, they want to manage their own risks. At the Sports Zone Science Exhibit in Philadelphia, a whole wall is dedicated to helmets. At one station, the kids push a button, then watch as a baton slams into the head of a mannequin.
My name is Frederick Bertley, and I'm the Senior Vice President for Science and Education here at the Franklin Institute.
So you spin it up to set up the program, and then it shows you the impact. And the reason why these are important is a football helmet can be used multiple times, whereas a bicycle helmet, when you have one massive impact, you have to replace the helmet.
When you go down on a bike, one spot on your head might get the full impact of that fall. But snap on a helmet, and Bertley says the plastic lid dissipates the force of that boom.
The inside part, as you see here, this styrofoam part, that actually then absorbs the energy that was spread around the shell.
As the helmet takes the hit, Bertley says the chemical structure of the foam changes. The cross-linked molecules can never absorb energy in the same way again.
It just takes one unfortunate incident to give you a traumatic experience. And, you know, of the 900 deaths that happen a year, bicycle accidents in this country, about 60% of them are specifically due to head injury.
Mark Bracey is a teacher who blogs and tweets about his biking life.
I live in Auckland, New Zealand, and I use my bicycle every day to commute. I describe myself as a wheel pedestrian.
New Zealand is one of the few countries with a universal bike helmet law, but most days Bracey doesn't wear one.
Funnily enough, in all my time, I've never been caught.
And still, he takes the risk. He believes in the environmental and health benefits of cycling. Bracey says those pluses should be counted up along with the dangers.
What I'm arguing for is a choice. Helmets are not, you know, they are not the panacea for making cycling safer.
Bracey says he manages his safety and rides with care. Actually, he said he rides like a woman.
That's not meant to be taken as a chauvinist, but...
In a recent study, health researchers found that female cyclists are less likely to be hospitalized. So ride like a woman might come to mean riding cautiously and responsibly. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. More on protecting that precious head and brain of ours. There's been a lot of talk about concussions, usually related to this sport. Or this one.
He was short, five foot up, and that is going to draw crowd.
But concussions happen in soccer, too. The U.S. Soccer Federation has recently issued new guidelines banning children 10 and under from heading the ball. Kids between the ages of 11 and 13 can head the ball during practice, but not games. The National Soccer Organization hopes this will help prevent nasty collisions that happen when two players go up for the ball. Remember the 2014 Women's World Cup final?
Two players are down. Hopefully that was not head-to-head. We're so far.
Oh, it was head-to-head, all right. American player Morgan Bryan was kicking the turf in pain. Germany's Alexandra Popp was bleeding. And both got right back into the game. That's not what parents with young kids playing soccer want to see, of course. The new rules are part of a legal settlement between the U.S. Soccer Federation and a group of parents in California. They claimed the organization failed to adequately treat and monitor head injuries. How are the new rules playing out on the field, and what do concussion experts say? Max Nesterak has more.
Turn, Gia, your voice.
You're not in the right spot.
I'm standing midfield watching a game between the Nether Orange and the Fishtown Flash just outside Philadelphia. The Orange are about in the middle of the pack this season. They've won some, lost some. This game, they're fighting hard and keeping possession of the ball. They're up 2-0, and their coach, Brennan Grady, is shouting instructions to his players.
Good, can we find another pass? Still at Mies. Good, can we slip her? Settle.
Grady's team is made up of 9-year-old girls, but this isn't herd ball. They're passing, dribbling, and sticking to their positions. This game is also getting pretty physical. I've seen a few elbows thrown, and the ref has called fouls for both sides. And there have been a couple of headers, but mostly the ball stays close to the ground.
Normally there's about one or two. Most of the time the girls will let the ball bounce.
When the game gets to the level where the ball gets in the air, usually around this age, that's when Grady tells me he begins teaching his girls proper technique for heading the ball. The Orange finished 3-1. I asked the team if they like heading the ball, and I got a mixed response.
No!
I talked to a few parents, too. Here's Paul Kalecki, a doctor. His daughter Jennifer is a center back for the Orange.
I think it's a good thing. Concussions
research is really important these days, and they have their whole lives to play soccer.
Winger Gianna Bergen's mom, Holly, has two concerns.
While I think that it's, you know, we want to take girls' safety into consideration, I just have a concern with what's it going to do with our level of play.
That's Tommy Wilson's worry, too. He is the director of the Philadelphia Union Development Academy. This is the most elite soccer academy in the area, and his job is to cultivate the next generation of professional soccer players. He's worried this ruling is going to affect his ability to do that.
Players have to be trained to head the ball properly. It's a skill of the game, and the players in the US are behind. We are behind the Frances and Spains and Germanys of this world. And if we neglect one of the most important skills in the game, teaching of that, then we'll fall further behind.
Just about every player I talked to at Coach Wilson's academy said they had had a concussion. He's in charge of six elite youth teams, and he says he probably sees about one concussion a week. Michael Pellegrino plays on the under-14 team.
Yeah, I got two concussions last year. One, I was going up for a header, and I got hit in the back of the head. And then the other one, I fell backwards and landed on the back of my head.
The academy has a team of medical professionals standing by to diagnose and treat their players for concussions. Michael told me he had to do baseline testing, which measures his memory, concentration, attention, and problem-solving skills. This is standard protocol in sports medicine now, and once Michael's scores returned to normal, he was allowed to get back into the game. Coach Wilson is from Scotland, where he played professionally back in the 80s and 90s, and was later a coach for the Scotland national team. I asked him if he ever got a concussion.
I think so, but I was never diagnosed. I was pushed off the field once and hit my head off a barrier and just went back on. And I was dazed for a few days and had headaches.
That sounds a lot like a concussion.
Dizziness, visual difficulties, balance is off, feeling mentally foggy, maybe a headache, feelings of nausea, fatigue.
That's Rosemary Scalero-Moser, a neuropsychologist and director of the Sports Concussion Center of New Jersey.
Basically, any change in consciousness may signify a concussion.
She says we don't have good data on how many kids get concussions from soccer each year. But according to one study, more than 45,000 high school soccer players sustained concussions in 2010, more than baseball, basketball, and wrestling combined. A good portion is related to heading the ball, but the ball is not usually the culprit. Most concussions come from players colliding with other players.
Head-to-head, person-to-person, knee-to-head.
Those kinds of concussions seem less easy to prevent with rule changes. In addition to the ban on headers, the new rules also change the substitution rule, so that players leaving the field because of a head injury will not count as a substitution. And they call for a medical professional to diagnose and treat the head injury. This, Coach Wilson says, is a good thing.
I like those. I think those are sensible.
But these rules only apply to member teams of the U.S. Soccer Federation. That means elite national teams. For many youth teams, however, these rules are not rules, but recommendations. The U.S. Soccer Federation doesn't have control over many clubs at the local level. But many coaches tell me these teams are likely to follow suit.
1, 2, 3,
for The Pulse, I'm Max Nesterak.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. The United Nations climate change negotiations are set to begin in Paris on Monday. 40,000 to 50,000 people are expected to attend, and a lot of them are under 30. For many young activists, the talks and what happens in Paris feels very personal. Carolyn Beeler reports.
Yanni Stefanson is going to Paris because she's afraid of her heritage melting away.
Climate change has affected my life since I was very young.
Stefanson is a 25-year-old chemistry master's student who will represent the indigenous Sami people of Scandinavia at the UN climate negotiations. She grew up in a tiny town in the mountains of central Sweden.
I was brought up in a reindeer herding family, and there's a lot of talking about weather and weather condition. And when I was fairly young, I noticed the talk was more about, well, this is strange, and Now the ices are melting here and the lakes are open there and such things.
Another strange change, winter rains that later freeze over can cover the lichen and moss that reindeer eat in an impenetrable layer of ice, making it impossible for them to eat. Stefansson says precipitation is also changing in the spring when baby reindeer are born.
All of a sudden, it starts to snow rain. And that makes it difficult for the newborn reindeer to become dry, and many of them freeze to death.
Stefansson says the stress brought on by climate change has only gotten worse as she's gotten older. The traditional knowledge of weather patterns that her elders used to depend on matches less and less with reality.
The reindeers and us will live side by side, and if they are in good conditions, then we are happy, and it's kind of the priority number one. It's a lifestyle, and it's part of our tradition, our language, our religion, everything.
Stefansson hopes to spread the message of her people in Paris. This month, she also ran in a relay race across Northern Europe in her traditional Sami dress to raise awareness for climate change ahead of the UN talks.
If I cannot be a reindeer herder, I wanted to help the reindeer through climate work, to work towards stopping climate change.
26-year-old activist Renee Karanunung will be flying from the opposite hemisphere to the Paris talks. Karanunung is one of 11 young adults from around the world shadowing their home country delegations through a program called Adopt a Negotiator. She'll be trailing the delegation from the Philippines.
So I'm actually currently living in Pasig City in Metro Manila, where it always floods. So during recent big typhoons in the Philippines, our city or our community is always flooded.
The capital city of Manila sits on a bay and has rivers cutting through its densely populated center. Typhoons have always been a problem there, but Karanunung says flooding is getting worse as heavy rains increase in frequency and intensity.
Now up to about like a month's rain can be dumped into the city in one day.
Karanunung will write about the negotiations in posts accessible for young people. A recent headline of one of her stories, Why the UNFCCC is Just Like High School.
So I think this is the problem of our generation, which we will carry on into the future. And the solution lies in us to solve this climate crisis.
Some countries save slots on their negotiating teams for young people. To expand youth participation outside of these official slots, the United Nations recognized young people as an official constituent group in 2009. That placed them alongside indigenous peoples organizations and women's groups, among others. Now, the youth constituency has a loose organization and no paid staff, but the official status gives youth groups access to the talks and permission to speak in front of delegates. Nick Nuttall is spokesman for the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, the UNFCCC, the host of the Climate Summit. He says youth have perhaps the most at stake there.
They are the generation that will inherit either our inspiring policies that governments take or the failed policies that governments fail to take in terms of what's going to happen to their future.
One of the people who's seen governments fail at a handful of previous climate talks is Nathan Thankey, the 25-year-old co-leader of the official youth constituency.
It's really tiring and really draining to go and kind of watch, if you're being melodramatic, like the end of the world being negotiated. It's very frustrating as a young person to repeatedly watch government sort of quibble over commas and just not live up to the level of ambition that we all know is needed.
Thankey is from Belfast in Northern Ireland. He's been cobbling together funding to work as a youth organizer on the UN scene full-time since he finished college in 2014. What brings him back to the talks again and again are the other passionate young people he meets from around the world.
You go out, you go into the convergent spaces, the art spaces, the squats. And yeah, there's a lot of energy, there's a lot of different things happening. You get involved in very different kinds of conversations. It can be overwhelming, definitely, but it's mostly just very inspiring.
Thankey is not optimistic that world leaders will finally pledge to cut carbon emissions enough in Paris. Neither is Stephen O'Hanlon, a 20-year-old junior at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania. But he still thinks it's important to go to the talks.
The Paris negotiations are representing the first time that world leaders are putting us in a different direction, putting us in a direction away from fossil fuels. And that's a huge victory for our movement. But it also, because it's not enough, we're going to need to keep pushing.
O'Hanlon sees Paris as the kickoff event for the next generation of climate activism. For The Pulse, I'm Carolyn Buehler.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Getting Americans to care about climate change issues has been an uphill battle for scientists, but they're getting a populist assist from Bill Nye. You probably most recently saw him on Dancing with the Stars, but in the 1990s, Nye inspired an entire generation of PBS viewers to love science with his fun and action-filled show, Bill Nye the Science Guy. The famous science educator and engineer has a new book out called Unstoppable: Harnessing Science to Change the World. I interviewed him at Philadelphia's Franklin Institute. We had a great crowd of 600 people. And here is a condensed version of that conversation.
Bill, thank you so much for coming to Philadelphia.
Oh, no, it is we who must thank you. Lead on.
Your new book is about climate change, and you make a case for us as humans to treat the Earth like a homeowner and not like a renter. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you're a renter and the ceiling's leaking, the roof is leaking, what else would go wrong? The dryer stops working. You call the landlord. And there might be a list of numbers you're supposed to call, but you don't bother with that. You just call the landlord and ask him or her to call the plumber. But if you are an owner, you got to take care of it yourself. And those of you who own homes or have an agreement with certain financial institutions to one day own a home, you know what I'm talking about, is that you, when your relationship to it is more personal and you have a lot more at stake. And so I'm sure there's a few people out here who have this imaginary idea that I'll go live on Mars. No, you won't. Okay. No, you're going to live on the Earth, and so we've got to take care of the Earth. And by the way, the Earth's going to be here no matter what we do. I want to save the Earth for me, the human. That's the key. And so there's going to be big changes ahead, but we want to manage them.
So you want us to think big.
Think huge.
But I think a lot of times for individuals, that's daunting because we feel like that is not up to me. I'm not the one going to Paris. I'm not the president.
Oh, you're going to Paris for the climate change conference. People ask me quite commonly, what can I do about climate change? What can I do about climate change? Yes, good not to throw away your water bottles to recycle them. Yes, that's good. Don't throw out your newspapers, recycle them. Yes, that's good. But I say the single most important thing that we could all do about climate change right now is talk about it. If we were talking about climate change the way we were talking about what went on in Ferguson, Missouri, or Baltimore, Maryland this year, we would be on it, man. We would be getting it done. There's nobody in denial about what happened in Ferguson, Missouri. There were some altercations, some people got shot that would probably be better off not getting shot, and so on. And so in the same way, if we were all working together to address climate change, we would be doing it.
But why are we not talking
about it? Well, nominally, the fossil fuel industry has worked very hard to, and look, I burn fossil fuels too, people. Okay, I mean, I admit. I got here on a train, which is powered by electricity, some of which was produced by fossil fuel-burning power plants. Yes. But the fossil fuel industry has worked very hard to introduce this idea that scientific uncertainty, plus or minus, pick a number, 3% or something, is the same as doubt about the whole thing, that plus or minus 100%. And that's wrong.
You have, in the past, changed your mind on issues. For example, genetically modified foods.
Yes, I've changed my mind.
Right, that's what science does, right?
Yes.
Science changes.
That's the goal.
So, yes. So,
but I claim I'm all justified in doing it.
Right. But let me ask you, have you seen any arguments or anything on the other side of this debate that has piqued your interest? Or that maybe...
On genetically modified food?
No,
or
on global warming. Have you seen anything? No.
No, sorry.
Okay.
No, you guys
just
understand. That's a good question. But understand that I, through a remarkable clerical error or something with U.S. Postal Service, something, I got into Cornell University. And I'm sure, now I'm sure they'd take it back if they could. But so after I finished my mechanical engineering requirements, I took a class in astronomy from Carl Sagan. I took one class from Carl Sagan. Well, you guys, it's just... that guy in 1977 was talking about climate change, and this was a result of his having done with James Pollock. He did the rudiments of a computer model modeling the Earth's climate. And the parameters that are used today really are derivative of those early mathematical models. How much moisture is in the atmosphere? How much heat does the ocean hold? How much cloud cover does the Earth have? How much does it reflect into space and so on? And modern models are based pretty much on those same 40 or so parameters or criteria. These were consistent. And so climate change models today, computer models today, are derivative of all that, and it's all consistent. I've seen absolutely no evidence at all that those computer models are not correct. And if you like to worry about things, this is a great time. Everybody loves to worry about things. July was the hottest July on record. September, when it's all settled, I'm pretty sure will be. This will be the hottest year on record. You can run in circles screaming. You can try to silence people like me, but the world's still getting warmer.
I have a question from Chris in the audience.
Chris.
Hello.
Way to go.
She, I think it's
15
she.
People. I'm Chris. Okay.
Neat handwriting, so I'm going to say she's a woman. Do you think businesses are moving in the direction of sustainable, clean, alternative energy sources?
Sort of. And here's a sort of. Texas. I was recently in Galveston, Texas, where you just see oil refinery, oil refinery, oil refinery, oil refinery, just one after another, all along the East Texas coast. Texas not only refines oil in a huge business environment, 10% of Texas's electricity now comes from the wind. 10%. And that's really without even trying. And this is to say, power companies have built these wind turbines to make money, not to be do-gooders as so much. Because here's what happens after you have a wind turbine. The energy is free. It just blows over your turbine, and it spins like crazy. They get so much energy. How much do they get? They get so much, they give it away at night in Texas. And so just think if we took the electricity infrastructure in Texas, which is enormous, and sold that power all over North America, all over Mexico, central U.S.
Is wind your favorite? Well, I got a sense reading your book that wind was perhaps...
Well, wind is so cheap right now.
And right.
No, it is. No, everybody. Fossil fuels, which pay no fee, no cost of their dumping carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, they don't pay for that, is about 1.7 cents a kilowatt hour. Wind's at 2.1. I mean, it's that close. If we were to charge a fee for the production of carbon dioxide, wind would come out way ahead.
We have a lot of science educators in the crowd, a lot of science teachers, right? And I have a whole stack of questions from them, so I'm going to summarize. What's your advice to science educators? How do we inspire the next generation of young scientists, whether it is to be scientists or to be scientifically minded citizens?
That's right. We want scientifically literate voters and taxpayers. That's what we want. So the first thing I say to every educator is let your passion come through. What was it you liked about your favorite professor or teacher? Was it he or she was into it? If it was Bill Nye, right on. I can assure you Bill Nye was really into it. The guy's crazy. I've hung out with him. He's nuts. He's like wild. Science! Like, dude, pull back. But... let your passion come through. That, and if you're excited about it, your students will get excited about it. And it's work. And I say this all the time. I meet a lot of rocket scientists. I spend time from time to time with Nobel laureates. These are not people in general you want teaching fourth grade. They're just not qualified. Sorry. I hope they've mastered the curriculum. I hope they got that. You know, especially kindergarten. That's where you really see these guys are just the wrong people for that. But you spend more time when you're a kid, you spend more time with your teachers than you do with your parents. These people are extraordinary. Teachers are extraordinarily important to our society. And so let your passion come through. And then the other thing I would say, whatever you're going to do that day, just have it thought through what you want to get across that day. And in my opinion, you can get across sort of three things. That's about it. I mean, you can hope for seven things, but you probably won't get seven things. Go for three. And if you have a better way than what I've described, do it. Because I'm just one guy with one opinion. But of course, like so many people, my opinion's correct, which is a big time saver. Yeah.
We have to wrap this up.
Already?
I know. As I was reading your book, don't kill me, but I was reminded of an engineer joke, if I may.
Yeah, engineer jokes are hilarious.
I know. So, the optimist says the glass is half full, the pessimist says the glass is half empty, and the engineer says the glass is twice the size it needs to be, and we can fix that. And that was kind of the message that I took away from your book. It's a big challenge, and it's a big situation that we're in, but there's hope, and we can do this.
About climate change, you mean?
Yes. Yeah.
So everybody, you have to be optimistic. If you're not optimistic, you're not going to get it done. Despite all the evidence to the contrary, I guarantee you the Philadelphia Eagles go into every game believing that they can win. And I can assure you that if they don't believe they can win, they won't. So everybody, let's get together and, dare I say it, change the world! Thank you all very much. Thank you. Thank you, my friend.
A conversation with Bill Nye, the science guy, on his new book, Unstoppable, Harnessing Science to Change the World. This was taped at Philadelphia's Franklin Institute, and Bill also talked about the many social media memes about him. I'm sure you've seen them. Badass Bill Nye. Did he really smoke a cigarette for that diehard spoof? Find out. The whole conversation is on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Tanine Dariush is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Paige Flager is our associate producer. Joel Patterson, the managing editor. And Megan Pinto, the executive producer. Did you miss some of this show or any of our previous shows? Just subscribe to our podcast. It's on iTunes. This week, we have to say goodbye to reporter Carolyn Beeler. She is moving on to a new position with the public radio program, The World. During her tenure with us, Carolyn introduced us to some crazy creatures.
A preening pair of rhinoceros hornbills are the first thing you see when you walk into the McNeil Avian Center at the Philadelphia Zoo.
She explained what it takes to pack up an entire lab full of gigantic dinosaur bones.
The bones will be shipped in 100 boxes and 50 wooden crates Black O'Vara made himself in the lab.
Well, you can't just, you know, go to Home Depot and buy a dinosaur crate.
Carolyn listened for water pipe leaks underneath Philadelphia's busy streets with leak detectives.
It's like a hissing sound. That's what a leak sound like.
And you could pick that up even with this water pump going and we're right on this busy street.
That's why you got to have good ears. As we say, I can hear a mouse pissing on cotton.
She trudged through swamps and marshes and even puffed some balloons for science.
Okay, this is like sulfur hexafluoride sounds like. Woo! It sounds sort of like I'm being anonymized on a hidden camera show or something like that.
Carolyn, we'll miss you and your stories, and we wish you all the best. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Supporting WHYY is The Pulse, AstraZeneca strives to create a culture where employees are excited by their work, have a clear sense of purpose, and display confidence in their ability to meet challenges and seize opportunities. More at AstraZeneca.com/careers.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.